Hello all, welcome to the God Said About Us podcast, a content channel of Kai Drakonis Books. I'm the editor of Kai Drakonis Books, Patrick Barney. I am here with a frequent guest, Hans Berger, author of the wonderful novel In Some Sense Innocent, and, you know, all-around intelligent person who knows how to speak about literature using the terminology of the field. So clearly he knows what he's talking about. Before we head into the discussion, I just want to remind everybody that as part of our anarchist position, all our content, including our books, the podcast, some videos, all of that stuff is free. You know, it's a statement against commodification and whatnot. However, if you would like to offer monetary support, you can go to the press at kaidrakonis.org. That's kaidrakonis.org, and click on the donate button. And yeah, we would appreciate your support in these trying times. So today, Hans and I are going to discuss a pretty darn interesting book by Sergio de la Pava. It's called A Naked Singularity. I believe it won some kind of prize in 2013, the Penn Albright Prize or something like that. But basically, it's about a lawyer in a New York public defender's office who... Certainly, I'll be condensing somewhat when I say this, because it's a big, fat book, you know, almost 700 pages long, and it deals with a lot of stuff. But, you know, if there's one major narrative thread that's probably the most exciting to a potential reader, is the fact that the protagonist, Cassie, gets caught up in this drug heist type position, and part of the tension in the novel comes from whether or not he's actually going to end up in the heist situation or not. So that's part of it. It deals with a lot of different stuff thematically. I think we'll start out with the thing that's probably the most obvious, and really what I think is extremely extremely important from the novel, and that's its kind of critique or satirization of judicial authority. Did you want to talk about that, Hans?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to start out with that. As you mentioned, the main character Cassie is an attorney who works in a public defender's office in New York City. And the opening stretch of the novel is him working a series of cases. I believe it's new arrests who are in a hearing to determine whether or not they'll be granted bail and how much they will be granted, how much the bail will be. And what you see is this, and feel free to jump in if you feel like I'm mischaracterizing this, but what you essentially see is this series of people who are poor, who are in desperate circumstances, who are addicts, who for many reasons have very challenging lives, and who have been arrested for things that are only very arbitrarily even considered crimes, or have been arrested on very suspect pretenses,
I agree almost completely, but there is the one guy who's accused of sexual assault.
There is, yeah. And it's not totally clear how credible we're supposed to see the accusations being.
But, yeah, that's true.
But, you know, most of the people who are arrested, they're arrested for having an open container of alcohol in a park after sunset.
Right.
Or they're arrested, you know, there's one woman who she's given an extra dose of methadone. And she's coming out of a methadone clinic. She has an extra dose, you know, for whatever kind of, to make sure she has enough for the weekend. Something like that, and someone poses as a desperate withdrawing addict, and buys it for $5, and then, you know, she's arrested as a drug dealer.
Yeah.
And the upshot being essentially that the what the court system is doing is not that it's working to achieve anything close to justice, but that it is basically just this kind of arbitrary thing that comes into the lives of people who already have a number of challenges and difficulties, mm-hmm. and just sort of kind of sticks a spoke in the wheels of their bicycle, or sorry, sticks a stick in the wheels of their bicycle, metaphorically, to really no clear purpose other than a kind of blind, smug, arbitrary exercise of authority. Right. And there's a character of a judge who at one point lectures the protagonist. I don't have it in front of me, but the judge says something about how, you know, she agrees with him that not all of this is particularly just, but then is presents it in this kind of smug, self-regarding way, and also frames herself as someone who really kind of shrugs off the idea that there's anything that she can do to make any of this less arbitrarily, randomly punitive.
Let me just add a little context, because this was in my notes. So a guy, the context is a man with three ears. He has a third ear, and he receives 3 to 6 years in prison for basically pointing out somebody who being like a conduit between a buyer and a drug dealer. So he's like, the drug dealer gives him a dollar for bringing him a client, basically. So yeah. I guess he's an accessory to a drug dealer, and the person he brings to the drug dealer turns out to be an undercover cop. And then the judge agrees that the man needs rehab, and then points out that she wrote an article on the whole system, but then instead of like offering leniency or anything like that, just takes the moment to plug the article and then you know, grind the person into the judicial machine, basically.
Exactly. And, you know, I remember, so this, when I read it for the podcast over the course of the last couple of weeks, it was the second time that I had read it. And my memory of it from the first reading was that you have this initial stretch that deals with the series of cases in the bail hearing, and that was this, I mean, it presents this very incisive, very unflattering picture of the judicial system that feels very authentic. It feels very lived in and well researched. You react to it with this kind of instinctive trust. Like, this is, even though I don't know anything about the judicial system, I've never been arrested, I've never been involved in it, there's something about it that feels very real and authentic. And it's a blistering, right, devastating, very effective critique. And my memory of it was that you have that stretch, and then the novel just does a bunch of other stuff for the next 500 pages, and none of that's nearly as effective. and that it has this kind of core strength that it gets away from. And on rereading it, I think that I was unkind in thinking that. I think that I didn't appreciate on a first reading how much, well, two things, partly how much that material does continue to recur, and then second, also how much the main character's frustration and disgust with that system are a motivator for a lot of the other things that happen. Because in my reading of it, at least, is that it is, the arc of the novel is Kasi's breakdown. Partly his breakdown, partly from his own frustration with not really being able to do anything to help change the meat grinder-ish nature of the judicial system, not really being able to do a whole lot to protect this series of unfortunates from that system. Partly that frustration, and partly also his own total poverty, because he's living under very, very poor circumstances himself. And the disgust that you feel as a reader with the judicial system in that opening system, in that opening scene, that informs a lot of what on a first read seemed to me to be either unnecessary or just material that was either unnecessary or served kind of an uncertain purpose, like the heist at the end.
Right.
On a first read, my recollection of it was that it starts out being this really effective critique of the judicial system, and then the second half of it is this long, complicated heist narrative that doesn't really seem to serve much purpose beyond being sort of entertaining and exciting.
Right.
And I guess, I mean, before I kind of talk about this, the better sense that I have now of how those things fit together, I maybe I'll kick it back briefly to you. Did you feel like the heist was pointless? Did you feel like it distracted from the kind of moral thrust of the first half of the novel?
I feel like, I've only read it once or listened to it once, but I feel like I'm siding with second reading Hans rather than first reading Hans.
Sure.
I feel like my own thoughts are a little rudimentary and inchoate at this point, and I was hoping, you know, through our talk we could kind of clear some of this up, but I
sure
feel like, you know, the heist is definitely related, and one of my thoughts is that throughout the novel it always I'd say shallowness of judicial language, or the kind of circular nature of it all, of how judicial language works, and how it all seems to be kind of swirling around, and it's confusing, and on one end it seems meaningless. Most of the time the defendants have no idea what the terminology even means. That happens more than once. So I feel like on the one hand we've got this kind of judicial language that serves as a mask for the corrupted core of the judicial system as Cassie sees it. And then that leads us into the heist, and I kind of see the big connection here being Dane.
Right.
Dane is this social Darwinist, is kind of how I put it, or at least I tend to think of him. He thinks that money is God. You know, he would pray to the god Mammon rather than any other god. So I feel like there's a definite connection there that I hope we can tease out.
Yeah, and one thing, I hate to just throw you another question before I express any thoughts of my own, but just another kind of thing that I was thinking about on the second reading. Do you think that, to what extent do you think that the heist happens literally? To what extent do you think that Cassie is an unreliable narrator? On a second reading, I found myself questioning, because he is experiencing a mental breakdown, and I found myself wondering if Dane exists literally, or if he is in some way a personification of some aspect of Cassie. And I also found myself wondering if Cassie literally experiences the robbery, or if he hallucinates it, dreams it, if it's a delusion of some kind. If you think about it, for instance, he never does anything with the money afterward.
Right.
It's all in a locker somewhere. And I mean, that's why, but there's no indication afterward that he has any additional money at all to do anything.
Right.
And there's a reason for that within the framework of, you know, the heist, but it also, it's one thing that you could point to cast a little doubt on, whether or not the heist really happens. And, another, there's a moment too where, it happens right before the series of letters between Kasi and Jalen King.
Right.
That we'll go into those later. But there's a moment where he has this conversation where someone at the front desk calls him and says, you know, there's someone here who wants to see you. He's massive. He's terrifying. We understand that to be one of the people that he's stolen this money from, who's this immense, terrifying an associate of drug dealers, a muscle man for drug dealers, this immense, terrifying man called the Whale, La Ballena. And Kasi thinks, okay, well, you know, he's here. But then he comes to the front desk, and it turns out that it's just some random person, and it's not this terrifying person, and it's not even somebody who is actually wanting to speak to him directly. It's someone who meant to ask for a different person with a similar name, right?
Hmm.
And that moment, that was really the moment where I, what does it mean that there's that switch in that moment where he has this conversation, but then the person that he actually discovers in the lobby is not this kind of terrifying criminal that supposedly is coming for him. So on the second reading, I mean, I do think that you could read it somewhat ambiguously.
Right.
I don't think that there's meant to be an absolute. I don't think the novel is meant to. I don't think there's anything in the novel that would absolutely say yes or no that the heist happened and that La Ballena is a real character, is a real person within the reality shared by the other characters of the novel. But I do think that it's not unreasonable to think that there are a lot of suggestions that the heist and the character of La Ballena are delusions. I thought a bit about the character of La Ballena. This is probably a stretch that De La Pava wasn't necessarily meaning to make himself when he put the text together, but it made me think a bit about, you know, you and Chris had that conversation about Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris offered the theory, this being Chris Malmberg in a previous edition of this podcast. And Chris offered the theory that the Whale represents kind of the terror of the nothingness at the center of a blind universe. Something
okay.
like that. Do you recall roughly what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yeah. I think his exact words were what's behind the veil.
Right. And it's interesting to me that the final image of the novel is Kasi moving toward this confrontation with the Whale in the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happening simultaneous with this sort of collapse of all matter. And this is
the naked singularity.
The naked singularity. And
right.
Just to back up here, I had mentioned earlier one of the subplots of the novel, one of the things that concerns the second half of the novel is a mentally disabled man named Jalen King who is on death row in the state of Alabama. And the main character, Kasi, is one of the things that he does in the second half of the novel is work with great passion and conviction on an appeal meant to save this mentally disabled person from being executed. And very close to the end of the novel, this person, Jalen King, commits suicide because he's held in solitary confinement for a long period of time, and finally he kills himself. And I wonder if I may be tying a few things together here that maybe I'm straining a bit too much to pull into one. But if you think of the Whale as being kind of symbolic of if Dane is symbolic of the part of Kasi that kind of gives into the materialist urges that he's burying to try to be this crusading public defender who doesn't make any money at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he has this hallucination of the robbery that ends with this sort of giant figure chasing him. If you see that figure as being representative roughly of the kind of terror at the core of something similar to what the whale represented in Moby Dick, right? The kind of terror at the core of a mm-hmm. of a dispassionate universe, the terror of the nothing at the core of a dispassionate universe. The discovery that Jalen King has killed himself, which is kind of the final expression of the disdain and dispassion of this uncaring justice system, coincides very closely with Kasi having this final confrontation with this figure, the whale.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't know how much, I mean, again, I don't know that Moby Dick was a conscious reference point for De La Pava in creating the character of the whale, but
there seems like a lot of similarities between the two novels to me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I haven't done any research on the influences that De La Pava was drawing right. on or anything like that. But anyway, that was the, as far as how the robbery and the fallout of the robbery fits into the moral arc of the novel or the moral thrust of the novel, that's really kind of what hit me on a second reading.
I will admit, you know, I tend to be a very literal reader, I would say, or maybe that's just selling myself short. It probably is, because I remember reading what was that one book by the same guy who wrote Kazuo Ishiguro.
When We Were Orphans.
Yeah, When We Were Orphans. I remember a moment at the end of the novel where I'm like, oh, none of this is real. Maybe I shouldn't sell myself short as a reader, but I will admit that I had not thought of that. I had taken everything literally, but when you say it, I think it makes a lot of sense. And it actually, reading the novel that way makes me like it more.
It makes me like it more too. Yeah.
Yeah.
One other thing, kind of a detail matter, but there, one thing that I think might support the idea that Kasi is delusional, his neighbors in the novel, there's some reference early on to them watching a marathon of the Honeymooners with the
right.
idea that they're going to that if they watch enough Honeymooners, they will somehow transform Ralph Cramden into a literal human being.
Right.
And around the time that Kasi is running from the whale, he encounters someone who it's strongly suggested is literally Ralph Cramden transformed into a live human being.
Right.
The first time that I read it, I found that kind of annoying and kind of silly. But if you read it as being actually indicative of Kasi losing his grip on objective reality, then it seems like it serves more of a purpose.
Right. I absolutely agree. I think that thematically, I think that it works way better if this is part of Kasi's breakdown as opposed to reality. Because
yeah.
I like it a lot more because it makes some of the things that I saw as missteps in his explanation of science a little bit better. So like, you know, a naked singularity is just a singularity that doesn't have an event horizon, so you can mm-hmm. see it. And there are certainly all kinds of there's all kinds of extrapolations from that for science that makes it an important distinction between a black hole, which has an event horizon, but for the purposes of human life, it wouldn't make much difference. You're still going to be crushed into some kind of density that you're not going to live. So
yeah,
the idea of a naked singularity, you know, somehow existing on Earth while life still exists, I found a little irritating. You know, the person in me that's anal and wants, you know, the concept you use to be accurate in the novel, you know, like that's sure. Like you piece of crap, what are you doing? But if it's just a delusion, and I'm willing to see it more metaphorically if it's a delusion.
Okay. Yeah, that's makes fair. Sense. That is fair. That is fair. And I think more than anything else, I like the delusion idea because I feel like it's the best way, and I might be repeating myself a little bit here, but I like the delusion idea because it feels like the best way to fold the character of Dane and the heist portion into the kind of moral arc of the novel.
Right, exactly.
And to empower, kind of give those more of the strength of the moral concerns of the first half.
Right,
of the novel.
Right.
There's one thing too that I thought about. You had asked about themes that we saw in the novel, and there is one of the things that I was thinking of as being a theme when I was in reading the first half of the novel was the idea of perfection, right?
Yeah, yeah, perfection.
The part of the reason that they do the heist is that Dane proposes that they'll be carrying out a perfect crime.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of, in the first half of the novel, Dane is talking about the idea of a perfect crime. Dane is very concerned with the idea of giving a different client a perfect defense. He kind of has this way of fetishizing perfection. And there is mm-hmm. one of the running kind of threads that comes in is Cossie discusses the life of the boxer Wilfred Benitez.
Correct.
And in the first half of the novel, he talks about Wilfred Benitez having an unbroken series of wins. And Cossie, this isn't referenced too many times, but Cossie actually has a perfect record within courtroom trials. All of his cases that have gone to trial, the defendant has been found not guilty.
Up until
Hurtado.
Yeah, Hurtado. Yeah.
Yeah, which happens, I think maybe toward the end of the first half,
right.
Roughly. So, you know, when I was reading the first half of the novel, the way that it was using the idea of perfection and the way that Dane and Cossie both value perfection, I found slightly abrasive. But what's interesting is how all of those are turned around in the second half. Cossie loses the trial of Hurtado. He loses his first court trial, which, I mean, presumably plays some role in his larger breakdown.
Right.
The crime goes very poorly.
Right.
I think the fact that Dane has this obsession with perfection that kind of quietly mirrors Cossie's less overtly expressed his interest in the perfection of Benitez's career, the first half of it,
right.
You know, his own perfect record. That to me lends a bit of support to the idea that Dane is in some way an aspect of Cossie's mind. And
that makes
but what's
sense.
Interesting is with Benitez in particular, toward the end of the novel, there's an account of the second half of Benitez's career where he, because he's unable to retire from boxing when he should, you know, he ends up poor and living with his mother in a state of really severe mental decline from all the brain damage of the years and years of fighting.
Right.
And so what starts out as being this figure of perfection ends being this kind of cautionary figure about wearing yourself thin by too passionately pursuing things that you're not practically able to achieve, or
right.
too passionately pursuing things beyond the point where it serves any purpose.
Mm-hmm. I also noticed that as you know, Dane's stated objective is to commit the perfect crime, and in the court case, his court case is perfect all the way up until he has this hesitation where he doesn't know what to say, and then everything's ruined. But the heist is almost immediately imperfect. You know, like it goes badly extremely quickly, and yet there's no talk of perfection. For Dane it becomes all about money. So and he doesn't seem to care about the fact that it is not a perfect heist in any way. So I feel like there's I don't know. I think I lost the thread of my thought, but you said, remind me of what you were saying again.
Oh, what was I saying? Well, the last thing I'd been talking about was the boxing. The image of boxing and how the figure of the boxer Wilfred Benitez goes from, in the first half of the novel, being an image of perfection, success, youthful energy, to this kind of sad, frail, worn out husk in the second half.
And what I was kind of driving at then is that Dane's talk of perfection immediately goes by the wayside, even though the heist is messed up from the beginning. And then all that Dane seems to care about is the money. And then that's mirrored again towards the end when we talk about Benitez going on and, you know, for money, for money's sake. So I definitely think that there is... You know, I 100% agree that Benitez is this cautionary tale. There's also that extra level, the sense of exploitation I feel like that theme of poverty or inequality or whatever you want to call it comes up again, where we're criticizing. Sure. Money as a social driver, or
sure,
I don't know.
Sure. You had mentioned when we were talking about themes of the book, you had mentioned skepticism of post-structuralist thought,
right?
And that honestly wasn't something that I was particularly aware of in my own reading. So I was curious to kind of hear more about where you saw that and how that.
Well, okay, so let me look over my notes real quick. I definitely had some specific moments come to mind, but okay, so I think it's mostly in as it's kind of a so a little roundabout explanation. So the character Angus. He's the guy who's running the experiment on the honeymooners, trying to get them. Ralph Cramden, is that the guy's last name? The character's last name?
I think so. Yeah.
To get him to become a real person, and this is like some kind of sociological experiment, and then there's also the experiment with the rat, where how did it work? The buzzer that tortures the rat is totally random, so
right.
it has to hit the buzzer to get food, but just randomly it also sends it pain signals. So this is another sociological experiment. So I definitely think that right here Angus is a satirization of the scientific viewpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Does that ring true to you?
It does, yeah. And I wondered when I was reading it, well, a couple things that I wondered when I was reading it. On the first reading, especially, and to some extent even on the second, of all the things in the novel that I had the hardest time, of all the things in the novel that seemed the most digressive from what made it powerful, what made it effective, the character of Angus and the kind of circle of people he has at the apartment, that was probably the thread that worked the least for me, and that even now I have the hardest time fitting into a schema of the overall novel.
Okay, and I definitely think that we should talk about that. But I think this is related. So I definitely think it's related. But basically with Angus, I would say the satirization of science culminates in this kind of final meeting between Cassie and Angus when Angus says, "Well, I'm screw social psychology. I'm going over to physics. It's a real hard science, you know. It can tell us exactly for certain about the world." And then Cassie responds with, "You haven't read your Karl Popper." He says Popper lays out that what categorizes science is that it's falsifiable. That means it can be, well, you know what it means, but can be proven false. And he points out that science is not categorized or not defined by its ability to tell us for certain 100%. It's categorized by its falsifiability, which, sure, you know, I've actually read Karl Popper's The Logic of Scientific Discovery, where he puts that argument forward. And I think it's a good one. But then Angus responds with, you know, "I have faith in science."
Mm-hmm.
So up until this point, I kind of like the critique of science. Mm-hmm. I think that there are some real problems with how the way that scientists feel kind of like they're the authority on everything. And does that make sense? My example would be the new atheists, three of whom are scientists, and they all kind of have this very authoritarian both tone in their writings and an authoritarian worldview, I would say. So I definitely think that there's something to critique in some of the newer developments around science. That being said, I can't follow him with this idea basically what I take this moment, Angus saying, you know, "I have faith in science," I take this as a critique, like De La Pava is saying, well, ultimately the belief in science is just like faith in God, which I think it's a fallacy that turns on the meaning of the word faith. In the context of belief in God, faith absolutely 100% literally means belief without evidence. You know, that is a virtue that's put forth, you know, in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, you know, say with the story of say the disciple Thomas. But in the case of science, it really can't mean the same thing. It's more like I believe, based on work done by others of which I only have some understanding. That's what I wrote. So faith in these two senses is not the same. And so I'm basically all I'm saying is I think that if De La Pava is trying to critique science, if he is, you know, satirizing the idea of science with Angus, then I can't follow him all the way. But on the same token, I think that that's related to this breakdown of Cassie. So I think that this is kind of the postmodern, this is the post-structural point of skepticism, where our own viewpoint, basically, if we're talking about extreme postmodernists, then the human viewpoint, the viewpoint of subjectivity, basically cuts us off from reality.
Sure.
Okay. And I feel like you know all this, but maybe I'm just explaining it.
Well,
for...
I mean, I knew it all 5 years ago. a lot of that is, I don't use any of that stuff on any kind of a regular basis, so a lot of it is kind of rusty. It's in the realm of things where somebody says it, you recognize it as being familiar, but you couldn't just call it out of your own accord.
Okay.
You know.
Okay.
It's like the difference between active and passive vocabulary. Like a lot of that literary theory, that's far beyond a literary theory, but a lot of the stuff that we learned in literary theory, it's in my like passive knowledge, not my active knowledge.
Okay. I've been thinking about it a lot in recent years, so that's what I feel pretty strongly about it. But that being said, so post-structuralism has this idea that, you know, language sticks us in our own viewpoint, and ultimately this serves as a kind of foundation of skepticism, right? Mm-hmm. Our positions are always biased, so we can't really have strong reason to believe in this objective reality. Now, granted, I'm condensing things, and I'm obviously not saying this represents the views of every post-structuralist. I just think that, you know, as a whole or in general, these are ideas that probably many post-structuralists would hold to, I think.
Sure.
So I think that explains, that works actually pretty well thematically with the delusion idea. You know, if Cassie is having a delusion, you know, he's biased. He can't understand reality, and so this kind of this idea that ultimately he's having faith in his own malfunctioning sensory or perception or whatever you want to call it, if that makes sense. And I don't know if on the delusion reading, I think that the faith in science from Angus works on that level, and I wonder if that is like something that De La Pava is trying to put forward, that we should be skeptical. I'm not sure, but I think it works thematically that way.
Yeah, I like that. I like that reading as a way to situate Angus and his cohort in a way where they have some amount of thematic importance to the novel. They do seem on first reading like just kind of this kind of comical sideshow.
Right.
And any kind of framework that you can give to make them have a bit more purpose, it certainly is appreciated, because, you know, I like the, on the second reading, I really like and admire this novel very, very, very much. And I want to I want to think that everything in it has some kind of... I want to think there's nothing in it that I would have cut if I were the editor.
I mean, I completely agree. I think this novel is really fantastic. You know,
I do have to wonder, and I'll let you, sorry, I cut you off there. I was going to say, I think too, one thing about Angus, you know, you mentioned that he drops out of psychology and goes into physics. Mm-hmm. And it's worth noting that at the end of the novel, he says, oh, physics, that was way too hard. And
right.
moves to Florida to kind of live in a state of permanent spring break, you know? So
right. it's hilarious.
Any perspective that he offers has to be taken with a pretty severe grain of salt, I think.
Right.
And more so, I think any interaction that he has, any ideas that he introduces, there's this way that they're kind of, he treats his ideas as more of these kind of toys for comical effect, you know.
Which I like, if that's true, I like the novel even more too. You know, if we're not meant to take, you know, certainly Angus, basically what I'm taking out of that is we're not necessarily meant to take Angus saying I have faith in science as this mirror reflection or converse reflection of De La Pava
that's what I'm trying to get at.
Right.
He's kind of a dipshit.
Right. Maybe that's just the point. Like he's a dipshit. He toys around with ideas. So maybe it's more like Angus is a caution against not thinking deeply, not thinking critically. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you could read him that way. Yeah.
I mean, granted, I don't want to say that that's.
I mean, I don't think that that's one of. I don't think it's. I think that's a reasonable reading of what Angus does thematically. I mean,
right.
Either way, I still feel like he's relatively incidental to the broader ideas and moral thrust of the novel. But I think that's a good way to, if you want to have a way to situate him, that's a good way to do it.
Mm. I feel like I really enjoyed the Angus parts. I feel like maybe you're selling him a little short in that I feel like there's a lot of discussion of I feel like the novel is really taking on the idea of epistemology.
Okay.
So basically just, you know, in layman's terms, how can we be justified in saying that we know something?
Yeah.
And more than once, Cassie puts forward basically a coherentist position. Do you know anything about coherentism?
I don't.
Okay. So in epistemology, there are a few different theories about how we can be justified in knowing something. Mm. Obviously, because that's what epistemology is. It's dealing with that. So there's one theory called foundationalism. So I don't know the name of the philosopher, but it's probably actually numerous philosophers who have said that, who've put forward the criticism that if we say that we have reason for believe in something, and so like I believe in gravity because when I drop something it falls to the ground, right?
Okay.
So what the critics of this idea would say is that, well, that puts forward an infinite regress. So if you have to cite a reason for believing something, then you're always going to have to cite a reason for believing something. And so we have this infinite regress. So like, well,
because you can always say, well, how do you, why should you believe that? You know, if I drop my daughter's pacifier on the floor and I cite, and it drops, and I cite that as a reason for gravity, well, why do you believe you dropped your daughter's pacifier on the floor? So you have to have a reason for that, because it could always be that you were just hallucinating it, right? Sure. So there's this idea of the infinite regress. In foundationalism as an epistemological idea suggests that to get out of this, we will have to rely on some things that are self-evidently true. Okay.
As in Descartes?
Did Descartes say that?
Well, I think therefore I am. Is that Descartes?
Yes, that's Descartes. Okay. And I do think Descartes is part of the foundationalist perspective, though I don't know more than that basic idea. I'm not sure of.
Okay.
But coherentism, which Cassie espouses, says that there are no self-evident truths. Rather, evidence only exists if there's a preponderance of it and that it is coherent with each other piece of evidence.
Okay.
Okay, so, for example, let's say I drop my daughter's pacifier on the floor and I cite this as a reason for gravity. And then somebody says, well, why should you believe this, you know? And then the coherentist would say, well, there are all these other pieces of evidence that corroborate this one piece of evidence. So the fact that when other people drop something, it happens, it gravity works on it. Or the fact that when we look at stars, we see that they pull objects to one another. They pull planets to it. So there's all this coherent preponderance of evidence. So Cassie more than once.
That's what any kind of legal decision is about, is a preponderance of evidence.
Right.
So that's the foundation of the legal system.
Right, exactly. And I feel like I've lost the train of the thought. What was the point I was trying to make with this?
You were talking about coherentism as a position that Cassie takes. It's I think maybe what you were trying to relay is that there's sort of an interesting thematic overlap where you have Cassie relaying coherentism in the epistemological sense and working within a legal system that is based on kind of a very similar framework, right? The question of preponderance of evidence. The interesting thing is that in both cases, in some sense, they're both wrong, right? Like the legal system that in theory is based on preponderance of evidence generates this enormous amount of bad outcomes, and and Cassie's epistemological, if you buy the delusion theory of the novel, then Cassie's epistemological abilities are quite poor.
Right.
Pragmatically speaking.
They are quite poor. But I'm not sure I agree with you on, I definitely think in theory the law is based on coherentism, preponderance of evidence. But I actually think the judges, and this is part of the critique of the judicial system that the novel provides, is that especially towards the end, when it's clear that the judges are just acting in their own interests, they just have something against Cassie and they want to get rid of him. They frequently, Cassie points out evidence that seems logical, that seems to fit with the facts, and they just move it aside. So are you recalling, like in the
Hurtado trial? The And I don't have the details up in front of me, but my understanding of what happens in the Hurtado trial, basically, Cossie establishes that the defendant is not guilty of the very specific thing that he is being tried for.
Correct.
And from a certain technical standpoint, Cossie establishes that, and the judge conspicuously refuses to allow the jury to view the evidence that will establish that to the jury.
Correct. So I feel like that's where the judge is actually denying coherentism, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I like that. I don't know if this is going to tie into anything, but it's something I was thinking about. Do you know what casi means in Spanish?
I don't.
Almost.
Almost.
There's a they don't ever translate it literally. There's an anecdote where they're talking about how he got the name Cossie, C-A-S-I. That's not a conventional Spanish name. And his mother was in the hospital, and the doctor came up and said, "Have you picked a name?" And she said, "Cossie," meaning almost, because she had almost picked a name, but then the doctor thought that Cossie was the name.
That's
but they
awesome.
Don't ever, yeah, but they don't ever say, you know, the De La Pava assumes that the reader has either the knowledge or the access to figure out by themselves that Cossie means almost. So.
Right. I like that. I think,
and that can't be thematically irrelevant.
Yeah, you know? That's definitely not. Definitely not. Huh. That's super interesting. Okay, well, you know, a long span of silence. Maybe that means that we've thought about it. Now it's time to wrap up.
I'm going to offer just one last thought here before
sure,
we go.
Sure.
I did know when I read this what La Ballena means. And the reason that I knew that, I spent a week in Mexico back in February, my wife and I did, or my fiance at the time. And over the course of that week, you know, I drank a lot of Mexican beer, which is pretty much all a certain kind of, it's pretty similar. It's like a little bit better version of an American domestic, you know, the Modelo and Corona
and all that
stuff.
A little bit
it's
better
all good.
Than Bud Light or Budweiser.
It's a little bit better than Budweiser, but it's in basically the same vein, and it all kind of runs together after a while.
Sure.
And I like it fine, but, you know, I'd had an awful lot of Modelo. And we were in this restaurant in La Paz on maybe the fifth day, and I looked at the beer list, and they had this beer called La Ballena. And I thought, oh, I haven't seen this on any of the other beer lists. It must be some kind of, like, local craft beer or some kind of interesting tasty beer that's more complex, different, you know. It cost significantly more, which I thought was a good sign. So I ordered La Ballena. And what I get, of course, is a mug bigger than my head filled
right.
with 60 ounces of beer. So and you know, I did drink it all at the one sitting and then went to bed immediately thereafter. So La Ballena is indeed terrifying. And yeah.
That's hilarious. Oh man. I don't drink anymore or anything like that. But
yeah.
There is a fantastic German restaurant here in Cincinnati that serves 3-liter beers that back in the day I definitely enjoyed not 3-liter, liter. Leader beers, excuse me, which is like three
Shit.
Beers in one, that I definitely enjoyed. So I don't know if I quite called them Ballena, but they're definitely huge beers.
I think it's your well. Were you going to say any wrap up things about?
No,
Singularity?
I was going to ask. I was going to suggest the next novel that we read.
Excellent. I was just about to cue you to do that. So what are you suggesting?
So I know that we've been giving the other person a choice, but I would really, really like to talk about this one specific novel.
Okay.
I want to preface this. I'm going to read the synopsis, but I'm going to preface it with
the fact that it's an extremely difficult novel because much of the dialogue is in Spanish. And so when I first read this novel, I frequently consulted translations of the dialogue so I could kind of follow along in it. And it was really enjoyable to kind of do that, actually. But so let me read you the synopsis. In the late 1930s, 16-year-old Billy Parham captures a she-wolf that has been marauding his family's ranch. But instead of killing it, he decides to take it back to the mountains of Mexico. With that crossing, he begins an arduous and often dreamlike journey into a country where men meet like ghosts and violence strikes as suddenly as heat lightning, a world where there is no order save that which death has put there.
Okay.
Does that sound interesting to you?
Sure.
Okay. It's called The Crossing, and it's by Cormac McCarthy, and it's my favorite McCarthy novel.
Yeah, I've never actually read any Cormac McCarthy. I've been meaning to for upwards of a decade now, so yeah. I will get my hands on it.
All right. It's extremely difficult, as I said. And also, it's marketed as the second of a trilogy, but don't worry about that. It you don't have to read either of the other two to know what this novel is doing. And it actually takes place chronologically first in the trilogy, even though it's published as the second one. So don't worry about that. It's on its own. It's totally fine to read. In fact,
I will look forward to it. And I was just going to say, A Naked Singularity is a reasonably challenging book. It's not the hardest, but absolutely.
I think it is.
I do feel like you probably owe me one after I picked that. So, or I owe you one for going through that book. So, didn't have the advantage of a reread either, like I did.
That's true. But I knew we were going to talk about it, so I paid a lot of attention, and I took about, you know, 6 pages of notes so I could think about it well. So excellent. We're going to talk about The Crossing by Cormac McCarthy next time. Hans, I'm really glad that you came on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. It's great to just chill with you like this and, you know, learn new things. So everybody, thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. And peace out until next time.